today on Against the Grain.
These seafarers are invisible. There's 30 of them for ships that are the size of a small city. Some of the biggest ships, the length of them is if you lay down the Empire State Building on its side, these ships are about that length. They arrive into a port and there are probably 30 people that at most, if even that, maybe 5 people that actually unload the ship using automated cranes. And because of this invisibility, of course, there is quite a lot of abuse.
It's largely invisible to most of us, but without the industries and workers that drill or mine the world's raw materials and the arteries of transport that bring petroleum and other resources across the seas, global capitalism would sputter to a halt. Scholar and writer Lale Khalili has traveled on the system's massive container ships and describes, in unflinching terms, the inner workings of resource extraction. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The extraction of iron ore and coal, oil and bauxite, and other raw materials fuel global capitalism, laying waste to workers and the environment. In her book, Extractive Capitalism, How Commodities and Cronyism Drive the Global Economy, Lale Khalili examines the costs of this system, as well as the many players that drive it, from the oil majors to the insurance industry, from management consultants to nation states. She's professor of Gulf Studies at the University of Exeter in the UK. Lale, I was surprised to read in your book that sand is the second most widely consumed natural resource in the world, that is, second only to water. You contrast it to a very different substance, oil, which of course commands a much higher price. What do those two resources, sand and oil, have in common?
I find it really interesting that sand is one of those things that is all around us, but we don't necessarily think about it, like air or water. And so to imagine that sand is actually one of the most highly traded, at least by volume, commodities in the world. In fact, the very fact that sand is commoditized, that it has been transformed from a natural resource into a financially profitable resource, is often quite surprising. It is, in terms of volume, one of the largest cargoes that travels throughout the world, either by land or by sea. Only comparable in terms of value to oil. So oil is also hugely traded, heavily traded, but the measure by which it's traded is quite superlative is its value. It's the amount of money people spend, whereas with sand, it is volume. And of course, the reason that we use so much sand is because of construction, because cement is so, or concrete is so central to the way that we build urban spaces, industrial spaces, various kinds of infrastructure, from roads to ports to airports. Concrete is so central to all of this. And for concrete to be constituted, you need cement and you need sand. And the sand has to be a particular kind of grade of sand. It can't be, for example, this is one of the really interesting bits of trivia about it. It can't be sand that comes from the desert, because the sand that comes from the desert tends to be wind eroded. And so it's both uniform in shape, so different grains are similar in shape and size, but also the shape of the sand grain itself is uniform all around, whereas water eroded sand tends to be both of different sizes across different grains, and it also has a more wonky shape. It doesn't look quite round. In fact, I would actually recommend to your listeners to go to an image search engine and search grains of sand under the microscope, because it's absolutely fascinating and they're actually really quite beautiful as well to look at. So sand is really quite important for these reasons. Now, oil is significant for other reasons. Oil is the basis of the global economy because so much of our energy, industry and transportation is dependent on various kinds of extracts from oil, whether it's heavy crudes, for example, that are used in shipping, or the very light jet fuel, which is used as its name indicates, for flight to petroleum or gas, as the people in the US call it, as well as, of course, petrochemicals and plastics. And so what oil is really significant for is basically allowing for the growth of the global economy, for growth of industry, and for the light that, for example, is shining in our rooms right now, or electrifies and charges our phones and laptops. And so both of these travel by sea quite a bit, because this oil obviously comes from specific regions, whereas sand, it also comes, it can come from lots of different places, but it does tend to come from places where mining for sand tends to be less regulated, because that makes the sand less expensive. And so you see huge amounts, huge volumes of sand traveling by sea to cities, to shores, to countries where there are huge projects of construction underway. One particular example of this would be Singapore, which is dependent, for example, on sand coming from Cambodia for its major construction and land reclamation projects. Singapore is an island, and it is constantly reclaiming land from the sea. And in order to do so, it essentially has to pour concrete into the sea to create land. And of course, that concrete requires sand.
What you're saying about sand and about petroleum and what you write about in your book, Extractive Capitalism, really shines a light on what is invisible to most of us, those of us who don't live in sites of extraction around the world. We don't often think about the materials that are necessary to compose the built environment around us, the objects of daily life, the energy that keeps it moving. And so I wanted to ask you, beyond sand and petroleum, what are the main raw materials that are excavated and sold as crucial commodities for industry globally?
Depending on what's going on, and depending obviously on the consumer of these raw commodities, the actual commodities differ from place to place. So to give you an example, China is probably the largest producer of steel, and therefore it is also the largest consumer of iron ore. And so huge amounts of iron ore travel often by sea from places that produce them in very large quantities. Those tend to be everywhere from East Africa to actually Australia is a very large producer of iron ore. Aluminium is another very significant commodity that needs to be extracted. And part of the significance of aluminium is because, of course, it's a very lightweight and durable metal. It's used in all sorts of things, including the construction, for example, of airplane parts. Also incredibly significant, and increasingly so, as we're shifting, we're seeing shifts towards more electric sources of energy, is the kind of resources that go into the building of batteries that are required for example, storing solar power or wind power. And these batteries usually require everything from lithium to copper, to a whole range of other kinds of metals and ores that whose names are quite unfamiliar to us. And of course, our telephones, our mobile phones, require cobalt, which comes from, for example, the coltan mines of Congo. So there are a whole number of different precious metals that are required for this kind of an electronic energy production and for its transmission. And then there are like the old school kind of metals that, you know, we have been using for ages and ages. As I said, iron ore and bauxite, which is the non-assayed, non-purified, essentially compound that contains aluminium, are two of these most significant ones. But what we're seeing more of now is also references to rare earths. We've probably, your listeners have probably heard about this very recently in the context of the trade war between the US and China, where China, which is the world's largest producer and purifier of rare earths, and rare earths are these metals metals that are, or these compounds that are extremely rare to find and very difficult to extract. The process of extracting them requires a degree of technology and industrial know-how that is not necessarily present everywhere. And in response to the tariffs that the Trump administration put into place, China said that they were going to ban the export of rare earths. And so these rare earths are absolutely crucial to a lot of electronic, for example, production. In addition to those, there are also some things that we don't often think about, which continue to be hugely important. So the counterpart of oil in some ways is coal. Coal is another form of organic matter that has been fossilized, you know, over geologic eras, over a very long geologic time. And in both cases, in both oil and coal's case, essentially these are the flora and fauna that used to exist in kinds of swampy forests, so prehistoric forests. And over time, they have become compacted underground and in some instances, because of various kinds of geological elements, produce oil. And in other instances, they become very compacted and become coal, turns into coal. But coal also has other grades. And so it can go from the kind of coal that is used in today, nowadays, primarily for production of electricity, all the way to industrial grade carbon, which is used in, for example, batteries in the anodes and cathodes of the batteries. And so coal is also one of the world's hugest, continues to be one of the largest commodities that is traded around the world. And it's following its extraction and production and export is actually an extraordinary window into the transformations in energy usage we've seen, particularly in the 20th century.
Well, I'd like to ask you about, as you write about, the different players that allow extractive capitalism to function. There are many, many players, from the workers that do the work to those who grease the wheels in various ways. But I wanted to start with asking you about the companies that are actually behind the process of extraction. When we discuss extractive industries, are we generally talking about private multinational corporations? How significant is the role of state, ostensibly public companies in extraction?
That's a really good question. So when it comes to oil, there are basically, I would say, three broad categories of companies involved in the actual extraction of oil, getting it out of the ground. And those would be state-owned, nationally-owned companies, which are primarily present in the Middle East and in Venezuela and a few other places. And these are either wholly owned by the state, or in the case of, for example, Aramco, 5% of it has been put on the market, and shareholders can actually buy it. Norwegian oil is also partially state-owned. Then there are companies which are called the super majors, and these are the names that are probably very familiar to your listeners, everything from BP and Shell to Exxon Mobil and Chevron, and these are publicly traded companies, i.e. they are essentially owned by their shareholders. And then there are smaller independents that are very prevalent in the US in particular, which are also privately owned, sometimes privately owned as in owned but within a very small group of people, are owned by private equity and therefore not necessarily publicly traded, but sometimes publicly traded. And these independents tend to be involved in extraction of oil from settings which are much more difficult to extract oil from, oil sands or shale fracking, etc. You find the same kind of complex of ownership in almost all other instances as well, in almost all other primary commodities that are extracted from the earth. There is, however, one other set of owners, if you will, that is being added to this group much more recently. When in particular in the 1960s and 70s, when oil and many of the other commodities were being nationalized in the wave of anti-colonial struggle for resource sovereignty, a number of different companies emerged in the global north, and particularly in the United States, but also in the Netherlands, France, and the United Kingdom, which were called commodity traders. What these commodity traders were essentially doing in the 1960s, 70s, until very recently, until I would say the last 20 years, is what they were doing was finding different sellers of these products and different buyers. And they were putting them, there were middlemen that put them in touch with each other. And these commodities traders are some of the names that are, they operate in lots of different areas. So your listeners probably know, have heard of Archer Daniels Midland, which actually, I think when I lived in the US, Archer Daniels used to sponsor PBS shows.
Indeed.
Which is a huge, major agricultural commodities trader. Essentially, they would buy commodities, they would buy agricultural products from farmers, and they would sell them to whoever wanted. And they had the ability to ship this stuff. Now, one of the things that we're seeing emerging in the last 20 years is that many of these commodities traders, which basically there used to be merchants, if you will, are now moving into the production of some of those primary commodities. So we are seeing Glencore, which is another company that your listeners have probably heard of, has moved from being solely interested in trade to actually owning a number of mines in a lot of different places, both in the global south and in the global north. Glencore is really present in Australia and in Canada and elsewhere. Vitol, which is your listeners are less likely to have heard of, is one of the world's largest commodities trader who specializes particularly in oil and petrochemicals. And they actually are very recently have started going into oil. There are other companies there, and what's fascinating about these companies is that most people, unless they do things like sponsor shows on public television or you've seen their advertising, they're usually pretty unknown. And I find their job, their work, really fascinating.
Lale Khalili is my guest. She's the author of Extractive Capitalism, How Commodities and Cronyism Drive the Global Economy. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So you were just talking about the commodity traders, but of course there are other players that are key for the flow of extracted resources. That includes management consultants and insurance brokers. What role do they play in this global system of extraction?
So insurance is a fascinating, I know that your listeners are going to think I'm mad for saying this, but it is a fascinating area. We often think of insurance as being this kind of a staid area of business, but it is in fact this combination of financial products with incredibly detailed ways of assessing what the future costs or possible trajectories of anything can be. That, of course, means that there are insurance products, for example, for bad weather. Your listeners probably, if they're living in hurricane-prone areas or in places that are subjected to typhoons or earthquakes, will know that natural disasters are something that insurance covers. Insurance covers, of course, our bodies, our health, what we own. But on a much larger scale, insurance also covers both the extraction of stuff, but also very significantly, its circulation. So what do I mean by this? In fact, insurance as a major industry in Europe and Americas really begins with colonialism and chattel slavery. And what it was initially intended to do was to provide a way to distribute risk between the different merchants that were involved in buying products or from the colonies or sending stuff to the colonial markets. And also in obviously the incredibly horrendous history of slavery, where the triangular trade of moving enslaved Africans into the New World was actually a very significant source of income. And in all of these instances, the humans that were transformed into cargo, the humans that were commodified, and the natural resources that were also commodified, were insured for their maritime travel. So insurance essentially emerges as a way to distribute the risk of maritime transport of cargo across the Atlantic. This kind of a hideous history, scholars have written about it, but it has become particularly public since the George Floyd revolts, where there was a lot of demand for accountability from the corporations that had extracted so much actually of their wealth through these sort of hideous activities. But insurance continues also to be very, very significant in the maritime trade today. The ships themselves are, of course, also incredibly valuable commodities. So there are specific forms of insurance specified for the ship's body. There, the cargo that travels on the ship is also obviously insured. And then there are specific kinds of insurance that the different companies, shipping companies, can buy for delay, for example, or there is war insurance, which is a premium is added to ships that are going through war-torn areas. For example, ships that would go through the Black Sea because of the Russian war against Ukraine are obviously subject to this insurance. Management consultants are a slightly different kettle of fish, if you will. They, and I say this as someone who was a management consultant in my 20s for some 6 years, today their activity is basically to tell businesses what they do and to provide them with plausible deniability if they do something that is really nasty. Not just businesses, governments also. And that kind of strategic planning actually often has to do with cost savings. And those cost savings often come from cutting employees out of the picture. But there is another set of activities that management consultants engage in, and that is automation, that's sort of the nitty-gritty of automation.
Right. So, you know, you were discussing risk and then how to cut costs, how to increase profitability. And I wanted to ask you, when you look at the different players who you've been discussing, obviously the producers of the extractive industries, but, you know, the commodity traders, the insurance brokers, the management consultants, what part of this process is the most lucrative, or is it lucrative across the board? And if so, why?
That's a really interesting question, because I think at different times, you will find that different parts of the process, different elements or steps in the supply chain end up being profitable. So to give you an example, during the COVID era, we had tools being downed basically in a lot of the world, and a huge amount of the global circulation of goods either came to a halt or slowed down. What you found was that in that moment, there was actually an across the board kind of slowing down of these forms of corporate extractivism, with the exception, for example, of management consultants, which really benefited from various kinds of programs to tell different companies or countries what to do about COVID, how to put into place various kinds of public health programs, distribution of vaccines. And in a lot of instances, the management consultants garnered vast amounts of money to basically build completely useless softwares, the track and trace, for example. App here in the UK was basically a money pit into which went £33 billion of public taxpayer money. But also management consultants were involved in healthcare, actually, is one of the world's largest sectors by expenditure. They were involved in all other kinds of stages of this process. Then we came out of COVID, and what you found was that suddenly there was this kind of a massive uptick in global trade. Shipping ended up becoming kind of feverishly busy. And so the shipping companies that had been in a kind of a lull during the COVID era. And in fact, in a couple of instances, private shipping companies in the global north had to get subsidies from the governments, suddenly became one of the most profitable. In fact, in the immediate post-COVID, post-lockdown era, shipping was one of the most, it had had its one of its most profitable eras ever. And then when you actually look also at commodity traders and when they end up being very profitable is actually when wars are on. Because when wars are on, wars are very good for business, and they're particularly good for unscrupulous middlemen. And so commodity traders can actually, sometimes in kind of borderline legal, cross those borderline legal limits and allow for trade between countries to continue, even, for example, when there is a war going on. So different contexts provide for different profitability at a given time.
Well, and of course, the players I haven't asked you about are the workers who are fundamental to the extraction and the transport of resources. And I'll ask you in a few minutes about the transport workers, but what about those who do the extraction? Does their work vary depending on whether they have a union or they have leverage? Is that also something that varies by context?
Yes, definitely. I hope that your listeners have seen the horrendous images that emerge from places like Congo, for example, where forms of extractive capitalism, rapacious extractive capitalism, are inevitably and horrendously intertwined with forms of coercion, whether military or policing coercion or workplace coercion, and we see young children, for example, involved in these open-faced mines, and it's horrendous. In other places, there are, of course, union protections for these forms of extractive capitalism. And if those workers can actually engage in unionized activity, they can extract concessions in ways that are not necessarily available to the workers if they don't have that collective bargaining ability. So to give you an example, the rig workers, the oil rig workers in Norway and the United Kingdom, and Norway much more so than the United Kingdom, have a certain set of collective bargaining rights that has emerged out of actually major struggles, and often in the wake of really horrendous workplace accidents. For example, in the case of the United Kingdom, a lot of those workplace rights and workplace protections emerged in the wake of the explosion of Piper Alpha rig, which was a Conoco rig, and entire oil rig blew up in the middle of the North Sea, most horrendously, sort of the sleeping block, the residential block, sank down to the bottom of the sea with all the dozens of people that were in it. I think more than 200 people died in that accident. And I think it was in the wake of such an accident and because of union mobilization that workers in the UK were able to extract certain rights out of the oil companies and regulations, because of course the regulations are where the companies can be held to account. But those sets of rights are not necessarily available everywhere. And I think that is quite significant. So in the Persian/Arabian Gulf, where a lot of the world's oil is produced, you do have some countries that allow some degree of collective bargaining, although massively and heavily coerced. So an example would be Iran, where there are unions, but those unions are surveilled and monitored, and the union activists and organizers can be subjected to political repression, imprisonment even, or Iraq. And then there are places where such workplace rights simply do not exist. So, for example, Saudi Arabia. And in the absence of those workplace rights, the process of extraction could become an incredibly dangerous activity. It could become a very dangerous job. But we don't hear very much about it either, because their unions don't also act as a kind of a tribune for those workers. Where there are unions, however circumscribed, as in, for example, in the case of Iran, those workers can actually influence not only their own workplace rights, but very significantly political rights. So whenever the Iranian oil workers go on strike, one has to really pay attention to the response that they get in Iran. Their strikes during the Iranian Revolution of 1978-79 was fundamental to the toppling of the monarchical regime there. And so I think that, again, it points to how important unionization is in this instance, and how significant, how much struggle has had to go into it in order to guarantee the continued protections that unions provide in that instance.
I'm speaking with Laleh Halili about her book, Extractive Capitalism, How Commodities and Cronyism Drive the Global Economy. This is Against the Grain, and I'm Sasha Lilly. Well, I wanted to ask you about workers who work on ships and on docks, but I realize that for many of us, the work and the harms that are caused by bringing goods, bringing resources of raw materials to where we live is, as I said earlier, pretty invisible. And I wonder if you could kind of describe the web of container shipping that is crucial for making all of that possible.
Absolutely. I actually am fascinated by container shipping. I'm fascinated by shipping altogether. I grew up for most of my childhood in a landlocked place in northeastern Iran. And the invisible work of transporting goods has always been of great interest to me. And container shipping is particularly interesting because it is, of course, one of the most recent sort of innovations in technology that has allowed for the transportation of goods across the sea to become much more widespread, much more standardized, much more profitable for the shipping companies, but at the same time resulting in, for example, the massive reduction of number of both seafarers and dock workers, and the deepening of the invisibilization of their work. So to give you a sense of this, is before containers came to be the primary mode for transportation, particularly of already produced cargo rather than primary commodities. Before that, when a ship would travel by sea, you would have dozens of workers aboard the ships. And when you arrived in ports, you would have dozens of dockers coming to greet the ship and help unload it. This really began to change at the end of the 19th century, not with container ships, but with oil tankers, where instead of oil being transported in drums, in barrels, which is actually why even today, you know, 100 and something years later, despite the fact that we no longer use oil barrels to transport oil, we still measure the price of oil per barrel. When the tankers were invented, and they were invented by, basically commissioned by the Nobel family, famously of Nobel Peace Prize, to transport Azeri oil, Azerbaijani oil. And these tankers, because they no longer had barrels that in their hull, in their body, to be transported, that you could get a pump to pump out the oil. And that immediately cut out a very significant number of both dockers and seafarers that would not need to, for example, arrange the barrels in the ship or keep an eye on it to make sure that there's nothing happened to them. So that was one of the first instances, one of the most significant instances of automation in shipping. And then the same technology, the same idea was basically used when a container was invented by a guy called Malcolm McLean, somebody who was involved in shipping goods. And what he was interested in was two different elements of using a container. One was in its intermodality, which meant that you could take a container basically off a ship and put it on the back of a truck or on the back of a train, on a cargo train. So the intermodality was really important. And the second thing was that it actually allowed for automation. Malcolm McLean was working at a time in the 1950s where the US dock workers were particularly powerful in terms of you know, giving their demands in for better wages and for better workplace conditions. And by automating automating the process of loading and unloading ships, what you ended up doing was you actually wrote out a lot of these workers out of the equation. In addition to that, when you have containers, you have to have large spaces where you can stack these containers and store them. So as container shipping spread throughout the world, what you ended up seeing was a shift from sort of the old ports, which were multifunctional, multi-product, multi-cargo ports, to specialized ports, particularly in the case of container shipping, which, because they had to be much bigger, because they had these mega cranes that dealt with the mega ships, they ended up moving further and further out of towns, and of course making those dockers more and more invisible. What is fascinating, and this particular chapter from a book called The Box by Mark Levinson to all of my classes. There's a chapter in Mark Levinson's history of the container shipping, which is extremely eye-opening. What actually made the container particularly dominant mode of transportation of manufactured cargo was actually the Vietnam War. When the Pentagon wanted to transport everything from the West Coast to Vietnam, it found that it was much cheaper to actually put everything inside containers. It also, assume that there was an element in there of sort of lack of transparency that a container provides that probably helped with the shipping process. And those ships that were going from the West Coast over to Okinawa and the Philippines as staging grounds for the and Osaka as staging grounds for Vietnam would end up essentially that resulted in the building of big container ships in Southeast Asia, East Asia and Southeast Asia. And then because those contracts with private companies, private shipping companies, were already paid for by the Pentagon, the ship that was bringing goods to Asia from California or from the West Coast was actually going back empty while the Pentagon had paid for that trip back. So they decided to make a little bit more money off of that, and they started carrying Japanese electronics from the port of Osaka back to the U.S. to be sold. And that was really the start of Japanese electronic goods becoming so incredibly dominant and the U.S. Economy, that the same kind of phobia of Asians that we see now being played out in kind of right-wing circles against China was actually being advanced against the Japanese back then. So the container shipping was really incredibly significant in this incredible change in the complexion of trade between Asia and the U.S. And in fact, that is where those webs of container shipping really took off. Europe and the Middle East were many decades behind in that sense. And we now also see that the world's biggest container terminals are still in Asia. The vast majority of them, usually the top 9, sometimes the top 10, are in East Asia and Southeast Asia. And then the next one is usually Jabal Ali Port, which is a port in Dubai. And when I was doing my research for a couple of books back for Sinews of War and Trade, I actually got on one of those container ships on two different occasions and traveled with them to Jabal Ali from Malta, from Europe. And it was fascinating to see the world of work aboard these ships. These seafarers are invisible. There's 30 of them for ships that are the size of a small city. Some of the biggest ships, the length of them is, if you laid down the Empire State Building on its side, these ships are about that length. And yet they only have like 30 people aboard the ship. They arrive into a port and there are probably 30 people that at most, if even that, maybe 5 people that actually unload the ship using automated cranes. And because of this invisibility, of course, there is quite a lot of abuse. There is quite a lot of depression aboard these ships. There's quite a lot of course, exploitation aboard these ships. And it was fascinating to be there, to hang out with these amazing seafarers from places like the Philippines and China and India, and learn about their hopes and dreams and their extraordinary skills in seafaring, and to do karaoke with them, because that was one of the things that the seafarers loved to do, was karaoke aboard the ships.
Lalai Halili, as you alluded to in discussing the history of seafarers, workers on ships, workers on docks have a long history of radicalism. And by automating the industry, obviously their workforce has been curtailed. But do you think that tradition of radicalism on ships, on docks, still continues, or have those measures taken to automate and shrink the workforce affected that tradition?
What a fabulous question. So I think that there is still quite a radical tradition that of the forms of organization that happens particularly on the docks. And we see elements of that, for example, in both 2014 and the Ferguson revolt and the 2020 George Floyd revolt, for example, in California, actually on the whole of the Pacific seaboard, where the Stop the Boat campaigns got together, pro-Palestine activists and Black Lives Matter activists alongside the ILWU, the dock workers union, and tried to stop the ZIM ships. ZIM is the state-owned, it's not really state-owned, but it basically might be, might as well be, Israeli shipping company that in 2014 was actually transporting guns for weapons for Ferguson, specifically for police departments in Ferguson. But then the same set of sort of radical organizations that happened around that time, 2014, were mobilized again in 2020, again against ZIM. And so that in conjunction with community activists, the union workers on the West Coast of the U.S. were engaged in what is this incredible radical tradition. We also see actually a lot of that kind of mobilization here in Europe, particularly in Barcelona and Genoa. And during the current Israeli genocide against Palestinians, what we have seen actually is a number of instances of boycotts of Israeli ships. And what's fascinating is that those Genoan dock workers that, for example, have boycotted Israeli ships also boycotted ships carrying guns to Saudi Arabia. So their radicalism is genuinely inspiring. And in the case of Italy, they actually called for general strikes, and they did have a one-day general strike in support of Palestinians. So that tradition of radicalism really exists there. We also have seen other instances of it. There is a much larger, longer history to this, particularly during the apartheid, South African apartheid era. The dock workers throughout the world were actually some of the most radical supporters in solidarity with the dock workers in South Africa, many of whom were Black South Africans living under apartheid. And I think that tradition, again, finds its echoes in the current pro-Palestine activism in a lot of the ports. Not all of them, though. And I think this is worth noting, that there are some places, and I think this is a combination of both histories of conservatism within particular unions, sometimes regulations, for example, in the United Kingdom, which hamper union activism in a significant number of ways. And these forms of whether it's state or absence of a radical tradition or corporate coercion that could limit those forms of solidarity. But indeed, actually, ports are still places where one can see some of the most exciting forms of worker organization.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the role of states in guaranteeing the process of extraction and transportation, including, of course, the singular role of the United States. What has the role of states been in extractive capitalism?
They play a number of different roles. I mean, and it also depends on where they sit in the sort of on the geopolitical, geoeconomic map of the world. If we're thinking about, let's say, the North Atlantic states, the Europeans and the North American states that have traditionally been associated with either colonialism or empire, the role that they have played is to guarantee their private corporations the kind of safety and support that they need in order to engage in that extractive capitalism. For example, example, before Aramco was nationalized in the process began in the 1970s, but it was completed in early 1990. The United States was basically the entirety of the State Department and the CIA and the Pentagon were forces behind Aramco, which was then owned by Chevron, Texaco, and a few other U.S. oil companies. And they ensured that Aramco got what it wanted in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia does not allow collective bargaining or any form of workplace protest. Those regulations that prevent those were actually put into place by U.S. company owned Aramco back in the 1950s. The same also applies, of course, with the United Kingdom and what was then Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which became BP. In fact, BP was, until Margaret Thatcher privatized it, had the distinction of being the one super major that was 51% owned by the British government. And so in effect, it acted as an arm of the British government. What was fascinating about these oil companies was that also in reciprocity for this process, they then provided intelligence and support. Pentagon got a really good deal for fuel from Aramco, for example. Now, these are states that had this control over these extractive processes. What we see with China today is a slightly different system where there is China, for example, its Belt and Road Initiative that basically consolidated a number of the different infrastructure programs that China had in the Indian Ocean basin and further afield. That program essentially provided loans and got concessions to the operation of infrastructures. And what this allowed for China to do was to guarantee the flow of the kinds of natural resources that it needed for its mega manufacturing processes. The big difference between China and some of these colonial predecessors was that China didn't quite use debt in the same way that some of these colonial powers had used previously. It also doesn't have the same extensive kind of military support for its businesses. It relies more on private security for its extractive economies. And then you have the states in a lot of the global south where these resources actually are. And in a number of these instances, these states actually have been brought into line with the global hegemon. This is, of course, not new. The prime minister in Iran in 1951, who nationalized the Iranian oil, was overthrown by a coup d'etat that was financed by the United States and planned out by the CIA and the British. Only a year or two later, a coup d'etat overthrew the popular prime minister of Guatemala because the United Fruit Company wanted to be able to do what it needed to do. And then you had the tripartite war against Egypt by Israel, Britain, and France when Egypt had the temerity to nationalize the Suez Canal. The 1973 coup against the Chilean president who wanted to get a better deal from ITT for the copper that ITT was mining there. It's basically a litany of states which try to actually exert some form of control over their own natural resources, basically being pushed out by corporations or global north states that rely on those natural resources for their own growth. And I think that this particular story is one that continues until today. What we're seeing, for example, in Venezuela is certainly, I would say, an extension of this kind of process.
We're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you very briefly about super yachts, which you contrast with the container ships that you've been speaking about earlier, their workers. For most of us who have not ever encountered a super yacht, which I'm guessing is most of us, what are they?
So a super yacht is a super large ship They could be sailing yachts, but more likely they are actually engined ships that the major billionaires actually use. And they are pleasure crafts. Now, your listeners, if they are anywhere near a sea, they can go to an app. There are a couple of different apps, Marine Traffic or Vessel Finder. And they could look at near that, you know, on that sea. They'll see lots of different markers on those maps for different kinds of ships. In the wintertime, if they look in the Caribbean, and in the summertime, if they look in the Mediterranean, particularly close to some of the more luxe ports in the Mediterranean, you'll see these little pink ship markers. And they, if they click on those ship markers, they'll find all sorts of information about the pink ship markers indicate super yachts, leisure crafts of various sorts, but yachts are certainly one of them. And then if you do a little bit of research on the name of that ship or the numbers that are provided, you can probably find out a little bit, not always, but you can probably find out a little bit about who the owners of those ships are. And these super yachts are really kind of crazy about what the kinds of things that they include. They have cinemas on board. They have helipads. Some of them have two helipads so that the helicopters can land on them. One particular super yacht owned by one of the Gulf princes, one of the Gulf royals, has actually an onboard sort of snow room, skiing room. Another one of them, also owned by a Gulf royal, has a space for a 50-piece orchestra. And so these super yachts essentially are the way in which the affluent, the billionaires escape from the rest of us mere mortals. And some of these super yachts have their own little service ships, which are as big as a super yacht. The most significant of these being Jeff Bezos's sailing super yacht, which is one of the world's largest sailing ships. It was so large that when they were trying to move it from upstream in the Netherlands, where it was manufactured, out to the North Sea, Bezos was trying to get the city of Rotterdam to actually disassemble one of its bridges so that they could take the ship because its masts were too high. But his ship is so big, but it can't have a helipad because it's a sailing yacht. So it has its own service ship, which sleeps something like 80 people and which contains all of the other goodies. And this service ship is an engine ship and it travels with the super yacht everywhere they go. I mean, this is how, you know, the other 0.1% live.
Lale Halili, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Lale Halili is author of Extractive Capitalism, How Commodities and Cronyism Drive the Global Economy. She's professor of Gulf Studies at the University of Exeter in the UK. Her other books include Sinews of War and Trade and The Corporeal Life of Seafaring. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.